Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you can join us once again, and let's not forget that just because we may discuss certain topics, including tax strategies or real estate investment opportunities, that you should not run out and jump into the pool just yet. Check with your existing advisors. Let's make sure they agree that what you thought you heard is indeed something that might benefit your goals and objectives. And for those of you that may not have advisors, you can go to our website at beaplanner.com. And if you'll go to the forms link, which is the second link at the top in the navigational header, you can find a list of four forms. If you'll fill out at least the first one, the client profile, that'll give us enough to have a phone call with you, which you can schedule at the link top right, far right, and we'll be happy to spend some time with you to explain how we may or may not be able to achieve your goals and objectives. And you know, we get a lot of new members of the assorted investor mentorship / investor platforms that offer real estate syndication partnerships, which that's kind of the sweet spot for what we do in terms of analyzing those partnership opportunities and looking at your specific circumstances, tax-wise, cash flow-wise, etc., to ascertain how those might work out or you to move forward. And you know, our goal, our sole objective is to help you understand what you're signing up for, because a partnership is not a partnership is not a partnership in terms of them being cookie cutter, just like the last one you may have done or the last four you may have done with the same syndicator or lead partner, as the case may be. And properties are different. The deal that's being offered to you may be different or will be different based on a number of factors. And you should never just assume, because it will likely have different outcomes. So in any event, welcome to the show now that we're through that. And, you know, I saw a article this week that it's not a done deal, certainly, but it's at least being talked about, is that Mr. Trump floated a no tax on capital gains for home sales. You know, I'm not sure in the point of, let's see, it's not this article. I saw another one on the same topic saying that they didn't think the author, I forget who it was, we might take a look at it later in the show, didn't think that cutting or eliminating the capital gain on the sale of a residence would do much. Because, I mean, I'm assuming you're aware, and I guess I shouldn't assume that you're aware of what the current rule is, but basically, if you're married filing joint, you can already exclude $500,000 in gain on the sale of that property, assuming you've lived in it. I believe it's 2 out of the last 5 years still. And, you know, I can say securely here or safely that in 40, God, this hates me to calculate this number, in roughly 45 years of practicing as a CPA in the city of Houston, Texas, that I have seen one client that had surpassed the $500,000 gain level. And actually, I may have a second one that just did it here recently. But I'm talking about on returns I've actually filed. And they did it on a home that they must have lived in, I'm thinking, 30 years or so. And it was in a part of Houston. I'll not say where. Just because there's probably very few parts of Houston that you could get that type of appreciation, even after 30 plus years. But anyway, they only went over the line by about $3,000 or $4,000, so it almost didn't count. But the reality is, most people are not going to create $500,000 gains on their personal residence. And I'm assuming from the very high-level approach that this article takes, it would apply to folks that are selling their principal residence. You know, it's – boy, don't I shouldn't have started down this trail, because talking about paying tax – on the sale of your home is just such a sore spot with me, because I don't know if you've ever been one to have had that happen to you. Good for you, I guess. But the problem is, you know, the gain on something held for 30 years is really, in many cases, no more than inflation. I mean, if we indexed for inflation on properties like that, there would be no gain. And so, you know, for me to talk about eliminating the tax on gains, well, that's to me commonsensical that you would not or should not be forced to pay tax on something that you've owned for that long unless it exceeded the cumulative exceeded the indexing for inflation. And since 1997, that has not happened. I believe 97 was the last year that the thresholds were increased. And I believe, if I recall at the time, it was because it was an attempt to reflect inflation. But anyway, President Trump, said that the administration is considering ending capital gain taxes on home sales. So the folks that are selling, the movie stars that are selling the multi-million dollar palaces, they may, I guess depending on where they're at, they may be the beneficiary of that. But or I guess a single person. I mentioned the threshold is $500,000 is the amount you get to exempt currently for married filing joint. $250,000 is the amount for single filers. So I guess that's actually more likely a possibility, and I don't think I've had a client in that position, maybe one, but again, it's just rare that I've seen that, but in any event. Let's see here, what else did we had a couple other news items that I can't remember if I marked them here. Let's see. Well, I did not do so. You know, another thing I wanted to do, and let me get this up on my screen. It's been a while, at least I think a month, since we have taking a peek at the U.S. debt clock at usdebtclock.org. And I can't say I enjoy looking at this often, but it does remind one of why we need to be looking at things like Roth conversions on our retirement funds. Because this, if you take a look at this U.S. debt clock from time to time, I think if you don't already understand that the tax rates will have to go up, this might get you focused on that possibility. And, you know, we're down to a matter of probably 3 to 4 years before we will have expended the remaining portion of the U.S.'s annual budget, you know, the tax collections that we bring in. And once that happens, we'll be in a position where we will not be able to pay 100% of the interest on the debt. And that'll be a problem, because if we think we're going to continue to sell debt, treasury bills primarily, treasury bonds, when people aren't sure whether they're going to get paid the interest, I don't think that's going to happen. And I think what will happen is the interest rates that we're going to pay people will have to be increased, because otherwise they may find something else to invest in. And of course, that's not necessarily an easy task. I mean, in large measure, I think the reason treasury bills or treasury bonds are widely held are for the, you know, the likelihood that they'll be repaid. But if you can't pay the interest on the debt, I'm not sure how we're going to pay the principal as we get there. But in any event, so looking at this current snapshot of the U.S. debt clock, and it's actually not a snapshot. This is a real-time depiction of the assorted math that involves our federal budget, our federal position, if you will, financial position. And it's just amazing that the numbers are what they are. The U.S. national debt, and for those of you that may have gone to this website, usdebtclock.org, even has a mobile app, make it so convenient for us. The U.S. national debt is over the 37 trillion mark now, 37,206,000,000,000, to be somewhat exact, or to be more exact. And that translates to the number of debt dollars per taxpayer of $323,053. That's what, theoretically, if each of us, if we just drew a line in the sand and said, okay, every U.S. citizen needs to, or every U.S. taxpayer, I'm sorry, needs to reach down deep and pull up $323,000 to send in to pay your share. If you want to look at that on a per citizen basis, every man, woman, and child, it's a mere $108,452. Both are staggering amounts. And if you look at the U.S. spending, the annual spending, and there's several ways of looking at this, but $7,227,886,000,000 is what, through this point during the year, and this is up to the second, if you want to log in and look at it changing. Looks like a pinball machine. But that's what we are actually spending at the moment. In terms of collections, we're somewhere in the $5 trillion a year range annually. And by the way, the federal fiscal year end, we're coming up on it. It's September 30th. So these numbers are almost fully baked in terms of the period that they're covering. But the deficit to date for this fiscal year is $2,008,871,000,000, and it's going up every day by, I believe it's somewhere between $8 to $9 billion. Billion, that's a B, per day. And if you believe CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, they do the annual, they update a 10-year forecast annually. So they're looking at over the next 10 years, our $2 trillion a year deficit will, on average, be about $2.1 trillion per year, assuming current interest rates and current spending patterns. It could be higher, but that's what you want to keep your eye on if you think you're going to play it safe and do your Roth conversions between now and then, meaning you're going to convert, we're going to convert your pre-tax retirement funds to Roth and go ahead and pay the tax at today's relatively low rates. And I say relatively low, it's the rates are at the lowest point they've been in, I don't know, almost our entire lifetime. So if you think you're going to be around, you're going to be living much past 2030, I'm going to suggest that you take a look at converting to Roth so that you can enjoy the rest of your life, at least in retirement, where you're pulling money out of your plans on a tax-free basis. And I know many of you, because I've got a lot of folks as my client, particularly when you look at the real estate organizations in at least the Houston and Dallas areas, Phoenix, Self-Made Millionaires platform is by far the most pervasive. And, you know, if you listen to the rhetoric that comes from that group, they believe you're better off just ripping the Band-Aid off and pay your taxes on your retirement funds totally. Just take the money out altogether. Get rid of the man, I've heard it explained, seemingly oblivious to what that does to the net worth of most families, because most families in America today, their total net worth, I mean, if it's not their home, unfortunately, it may just be their home, is what's in their breadwinners, or if both spouses are breadwinners, it's what's in their 401 plans. And to even think about cashing those out, I don't care what you're going to do with the money, to cash it out is a crazy notion. It's an insane notion, because you can invest in real estate and reap the benefits of the cash flow. There is a tool to do that within the retirement fund arena, to where you can do everything you would want to do, doing the cash out option that you're told about, except how many of you want to write a check to the IRS for 30 to 40% of what minimum, maybe higher, if you live in a state that's also got a federal income tax, and if your funds are high enough, your balance in the 401, you could get up into the 37% bracket. Plus, you could have the net investment income tax laid on top of that, so you'd be over 40, before you consider the state impact. So I'll just ask you, you know, again, if you got a million, let's say you're above average, you're still not set for retirement, but let's say you got $1 million in your 401, you know, do you want to wake up the morning after and have maybe 600,000, maybe less than that left in your 401? Especially when you find out from some guy on the radio, some CPA, that you didn't have to do it to join an investor platform and invest in the real estate partnership syndications. You could have done all of it without paying one penny of tax. And the power of knowledge, what's the value of knowledge? And when you sign up and pay big fees to the platforms that are out there as an option for real estate investors to participate in transactions like this, who's going to give you your money back once you realize, oh, I didn't have to cash my funds out to invest in the same partnerships? And you're saying I could be taking money out of those self-directed 401 plans the next day after I've created or adopted the plan and rolled my funds out of my companies or my IRAs in to that plan? And people don't take that news, you know, they're not very happy when they hear that news. And I guess I would question, and I've been a member of many of the platforms in the Houston area, most of them, and including Self-Made Millionaires platform, and I give kudos to him on many fronts, but this is one front that more damage has been done. I don't know if I can believe the numbers, but if I took his numbers and extrapolated out, I don't know, $300,000 to $500,000 on average in the supposed number of members he has that, you know, may or may not have participated in the syndication investments. But let's just do some averages. It's literally hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes at a minimum that his investment or his knowledge base, his investment advice, has caused people to unwittingly paid. And again, the beauty of the self-directed 401 model is that you yourself will become the trustee of the funds. You'll become the administrator. You'll also be a participant. And once you have your funds rolled into the self-directed 401 trust, also known in the marketing of the IRA custodial firms as a solo K, the tax code doesn't have that word appear anywhere in the code, so we use self-directed 401 trust as the number or the name. But in any event, well, I'll tell you what, let's take our break. We'll take a break here and circle back momentarily, and I'll tell you the best news or the best rules that apply once you get your money rolled over into the 401 trust and have invested in the same partnerships that you would be able to invest in if you believe the mantra of ripping the Band-Aid off and getting rid of the man. And we'll talk more about that here when we circle back. We'll be back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Grindstones and rhinestones have made up my life, but I shine like a diamond through. Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough.
Okay, welcome back. More of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And, you know, I was just looking at this U.S. debt clock a little bit more in depth. They've added some math metrics for 2025 that were not on here in prior years. I'm not sure what it says about their political leanings, but they've added things like border encounters 2024 versus 2025. It's striking, you know, border encounters, and I don't know exactly what goes into a quote encounter being logged, but it's probably higher than what these numbers show if we knew, because of the way it was being reported a year ago. But 2024, 1,777,044 encounters. And I'm assuming encounters are not resulting from someone that shows up legally at the border and comes through the entry points, is, I don't know if the right word would be processed or cataloged. In other words, they're accounted for and given whatever a next step outcome is, whether it's, you know, wait for your citizenship hearing or asylum hearing, whatever it is that you're claiming. But whatever it is, it's still significant that it's roughly 1.7 million more last year than it is here in 2025. It is a 95.85% change. And so any way you want to look at it, and I know, you know, I understand from a math and a tax standpoint both sides of the argument. I'm going to tell you right now, if we don't get more able-bodied younger people into the workforce, all of us old people, myself included, are going to have a problem collecting Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, the rest of our lives. Folks, we've got a long time to live. According, even the IRS's life expectancy tables shows folks like myself, I'm 65 currently, and the IRS projects that I'll live to a ripe old age of 85 before I pass away. That's a lot of money to pay for my medical care, and I'm not on Social Security yet, but, you know, Social Security it pains me to think about whether there'll be Social Security for most of the next 20 years. I'm hoping some common sense prevails here real quick before the trust fund is depleted, and everyone that's on Social Security at that point will take a 25% hit, somewhere between 23 and 25. Let's just think big. 25% haircut off of whatever your check was the month before and what it's going to be at that point when sometime in 2028, 29, or 30, it depends on some of the assumptions that are deployed. Yeah, what rate of interest will the government be paying? What sorts of other expenditures will be included? You can look at the inflationary effects. In any event, it'll happen no later than 2030. And so, when you think about the impact of all the different constraints that are working in concert, the budget items, the four largest budget components. We just had a major change within the past year where the interest on our debt became more than $1 trillion for the first time in our history. $1 trillion. It was the fourth most material or largest component of the annual expenditure. Now it's number third. Defense actually fell. Defense didn't fall in terms of the total dollars, but its position relative to the other three dropped one. It's in fourth place now. Social Security is in second place. So you've got the fourth position is defense. Third position is interest on the debt. Second position is Social Security, and coming in first is the combined Medicare/Medicaid expenditure, $1.694 trillion. And I may have said it incorrectly. Social Security, it's not $1.5 billion, it's $1.532 trillion. These are huge, huge numbers. But it gets worse. I mean, if you look at those numbers, or the numbers we went over earlier, the $37 trillion in national debt, that's not the total U.S. debt. That's the piece that we admit to and we include it because, or we talk about it because it's part of the current year budget cycle. The total unfunded interest, or the total debt upon which unfunded interest is being paid, is $105 trillion. And that's for things that are already approved, they've already been passed into legislation, but they don't take effect for some period past the current year. And you've got tons of indexed spending items that go in there. You've got a lot of forward-looking employee benefit plans that get paid out to government employees. We should do a show sometime here soon that breaks down the details on that unfunded debt. It's just crazy how much money and the stuff that all goes into that calculation. Let's see. I was starting to talk about, I hadn't got to that point yet. I was going to mention the, the trade deficit, which is also part of this analysis. Let me see here. If I can find it real quick. These numbers are difficult to read if you got old eyes like I've got. So here's the U.S. trade deficit in toto. Millions, billions. So it's total is 1.3, almost $1.4 trillion is the total U.S. trade deficit for the current year. The U.S. trade deficit with just China is $291 billion. And let's see. Well, that's the only country they've got broken out. Let's see here. I guess another interesting metric that was added a few months back is the Doge clock. That's the clock that's counting the savings. Total savings, according to the economist here at usdebtclock.org, is almost $587 billion for the year. Savings per taxpayer is $5,225. That's, you know, a drop in the bucket, obviously, but keep going. I mean, you know, let's keep doing it, and eventually we'll have more material numbers. Okay, so before we left for the break, we were talking about a number of things, but primarily I had mentioned the concept of rolling your current retirement accounts into a self-directed 401 trust if you qualify. And I'm not going to get into qualifications today. In fact, you know, maybe someday here soon again. I mean, we've talked about them before, but I just want to get you focused and feel like there is a solution. You know, if you're wondering where my retirement money is going to, or how will it be used in terms of how much will I have to use each year. And, of course, the higher taxes go, the less going to be available for you to live on. And I know, you know, some of you may have forgotten that just because you may have, let's say you've been a good boy or girl and you've saved and you've got a couple million dollars in your 401. First of all, congratulations, you're way above the average U.S. Even U.S. employee, but certainly U.S. saver. But you're also still significantly behind the eight ball when it comes to what you're going to need to make it through the rest of your 85 to 86-year-old life if you're a male, 87 to 88 if you're a female. And those are numbers from the IRS's life expectancy tables. And so, you know, when we talk to people that say, well, I've got $2 million in my 401k, I think I'm going to be okay. Well, first of all, you don't have $2 million because you haven't taken care of your silent partner yet that's going to get paid every time you take something out for yourself. You got to pay the man, as some would call it, the IRS. And the longer you're able to delay taking funds out, the higher that amount will be based on the required minimum distributions, which means more will go to the IRS over the years than would now if you did it under the current tax brackets and tax rates. Further, if you've invested your money in real estate private partnership syndications and or other private companies, and there's rules for being able to do certain things, so don't just go haul off and do it without getting someone that understands what those rules are. But the real estate rules are really the low-hanging fruit, the private partnership syndications. And once your money's invested in a private company, when you value the amount of your Roth conversions that you're going to undertake, you get discounts to the amount of money that you put in to the investment. So you could have put $100,000 in it, but you might be paying tax as you undertake the Roth conversion, excuse me, on an amount much smaller because of the private company discounts we get. Unlike the public market, things like Apple stock or Ford or whoever, you know, the publicly traded companies, those companies are pretty much valued at what you paid or higher. There's a public, you know, the quote at the end of business each day is the fair market value that you would have to utilize to commit or to do a Roth conversion. Whereas on these private partnership syndications, there is no market that you can look at. Further, you've got discounts for things like lack of marketability. You've got lack of minority or majority control discounts. You've got discounts for the fact that real estate is not a guarantee at any stretch of the imagination. You may not be able to rent your units when you think you will. If you look at the pro forma financials, that'll give you a good idea of what some of the risk factors are. And, of course, the risk factors are identified in every private placement memorandum that you'll be provided before you invest. So you really want to look at those factors to understand, okay, this is what Nathan Ross was talking about in terms of using that information to determine the fair market value of my Roth conversion. In other words, we're going to value the piece or the, you know, maybe you convert 30% of your pre-tax 401 investment on a given transaction to the Roth side of your adopted self-directed 401 trust. And so we're going to value it based on the net value after the assorted discounts that are allowed to those that are investing in real estate private partnerships. So it's a win-win scenario. And if you look at the difference between the Roth conversion tax that one would pay if you converted your funds at when they were still sitting at Charles Schwab, or even after you've rolled them to the self-directed 401 model, if you go and convert before you've invested in private company transactions, you're going to pay a lot more money. And so, you know, what I have come to realize over the years doing this a lot is that most people are, it takes them a while to grab onto the concept, but invariably they get to a point where they realize, well, gee, if I'm able to convert to Roth, where I'm going to get the rest of my life, you know, gains or distributions that come out of those partnerships are going to go back to my Roth 401, no tax. No tax will ever be paid, assuming you have the qualified Roth. We've got a couple five-year rules to work with, but that's just on the profit that gets earned. You can still take your principal money out tomorrow. And that's something that a lot of the real estate gurus, even some of the ones I like Self-Made Millionaire, they don't tell you that. They make it sound like it's a unilateral scenario. It's a one-way street where you're only putting money into the 401. Can't touch it, can't use it until you're old, and then you don't want to do any traveling, you don't want to do much of anything because you'll be old and tired. Well, I got news for you. That is part of getting old, but you don't have to wait to enjoy the savings that you've been able to amass on the way to, I'm going to say, refocusing life instead of the word retirement. I think retirement's a bad word. I like refocused. And I'll tell you right now, not only will you be able to access it, you'll be able to access more of it. Why? Because you didn't give 40% of it away to the government. The Roth conversion won't happen nearly as punitively as the upfront rip the Band-Aid off approach where you're paying tax on the whole thing. You might even decide you don't want to convert the entirety of your pre-tax funds in the 401 over to Roth all at one time. You may want to delay. You could do any timeline you want, although, you know, we're always looking at what will rates be, you know, next year, the year after, you know, 5 years out. And so we're trying to take advantage when we do the Roth conversion for a client. We're looking at what their current year's income is from the other components, you know, be it a job or be it dividends and interest or be it real estate transactions are already in. We're trying to time the recognition of that Roth conversion income so that we stay down in the 22 to 24% tax brackets on the high end, because that's just the most efficient way to approach the Roth conversion. And I know, you know, there have been some folks that they're saying, well, gee, you know, if I'm, let's say I'm in the top bracket, the top bracket's going to go up too when everything goes cattywampus, you know, when 2028, 29, or 30 finally gets here, and we've got a problem because we weren't savvy in terms of adjusting our spending or the way we collect revenues. But, you know, even someone paying 40% today could be paying 60 tomorrow. And lest you think I jest when it comes to these possible tax rates, I'll refer once again to CBO. CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, at the request of Congress back in 2008, prepared a plan, or maybe a plan is the wrong word. The question was, what do rates need to be to avoid such an extreme deficit that it's going to cause our nation significant problems later? So what do we do to get the deficit under control? What would the tax rates have to be? And this was 2009 when they delivered the study. Dear Mr. Ryan, or Dear Honorable Ryan, that was Paul Ryan, who was then the Speaker of the House, they said there were three brackets back then, 10, 25, and the last one escapes me. I'll get there in a second. The 10% bracket would need to go to 25. That's 150% increase. The 25% bracket would need to go to 63. And the 39, that was the highest bracket, the 39% bracket would need to go to 88%. Think about that, folks. That was 2009. Now, and those were 150% increases in the presumed rates to get the debt under control. And I can't remember if it was to actually balance the budget. I mean, my goodness, why would we ever think of doing anything that sane when it comes to congressional political spending? But in any event, now, if you fast forward up to today, it's at least a 200% increase that it would take to eradicate the deficit. And so, again, don't believe me, you know, if you don't want to. I don't know. I mean, I'm just an accountant. But believe CBO if you think they're good at calling the balls and strikes for Congress's legislation. I'd say they miss just as many as they hit. But, okay, it's at least ostensibly a nonpartisan body of economists, et cetera. But anyway, the Roth conversion is absolutely one of the best tools we have. You could also do some index universal life, perhaps, that has some significant advantages in terms of tax. By the way, under the current Internal Revenue Code, the insurance industry, their lobby, has been able to keep absolutely the best, as an industry, the best tax shelters that are still available. And if you're still in an age and a health condition where you can qualify, I would strongly urge you to take a look at that. And I'm very pro real estate, but I'm also very practical, and I'm going to suggest some diversification between real estate and cash value insurance policies would be wise. Okay, well, we're very close here to the end of the show. We've got less than a minute. I just want to thank you for tuning in, and once again, and you know, we look forward to Sunday at 7 a.m. We'll be back here, KSEV, AM 700, talking either more real estate or our cyber security show will be on Sunday, assuming my AI cyber expert, Mr. Win Win, can join us once again. So thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.